This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Pick your metaphor. High noon, moment of truth, acid test. Any way you slice it, this really is big. The president tonight before Congress and the nation to make his case for health care reform. It has been a rugged month and more for the reform drive with town hall fireworks and battered polls. But behind it all, there are real problems with American health care, and Americans know it. Something big may yet happen, or it may not. This hour on Point, the president steps to the plate on health care. You can join the conversation. What do you hope to hear in tonight's speech? Big compromise, tough demands. Can something important still happen here? Should it? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us first today from Washington, D.C., is U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services and former Governor of Kansas, Kathleen Sebelius. Madam Secretary, thanks for being here on this big day.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
So what's the president's challenge tonight? How would you describe it, madam?
Well, I think the president will focus Congress on what's at stake if nothing happens with health reform, and remind people that the cost of doing nothing is extraordinary to our family budgets, to our business budgets, and to government budgets. That's just not an option. I think he will talk with some specificity about what's at stake in terms of individuals, how this will protect Americans who currently have insurance coverage by stabilizing the market and lowering costs and beginning to drive quality outcomes for Americans, and how it will help those Americans who either are underinsured or totally uninsured by creating a new marketplace with affordable coverage. How it's important that for once and for all, we're going to change the rules that insurance companies operate under. No longer do they get to pick and choose who in America has access to quality health care. And that impacts everyone who either is trying to buy coverage or who currently has coverage, that they shouldn't be denied coverage because they get sick. They shouldn't be dumped out of a plan because their coverage has run out. They shouldn't have to worry about what happens next week or next month if they lose their coverage and they've got an underlying health condition. And then I think just talk about the steps that Congress needs to make and remind people that we are actually in this process further than we've ever been before in history, that Congress is poised with not only bills in the House, but one bill in the Senate, another, I think, is coming, and that the challenge now is over the next couple of months to get a bill to the president's desk that he can sign.
Did President Obama make a mistake in leaving the making of the sausage up to Congress? And will he reverse that tonight? Is he going to lay it out and say, this is what I want, A, B, C, D, right on down the line, here it is?
Well, I don't think there's a mistake in having members of Congress own a work product that has this kind of significance. And frankly, the efforts that have gone on over the last several months are going to pay huge dividends because lots and lots of members of the House and members of the Senate now know a lot more about our health care system than they did before this debate started. And they are engaged and involved, and they've not only educated themselves, but are prepared to educate their constituents. That is always good news.
Why do you think we saw the town hall fireworks in this last month, Secretary Sebelius?
Well,
what was going on there?
I think a couple of things go on. First of all, health care is very personal, and a lot of misinformation was intentionally spread, scaring seniors, trying to frighten people about what they would lose. And I think that is always scary to folks. I found, at least, Tom, as I traveled around, that the misinformation was corrected along the way, and as the real facts got out of what benefits there are for Medicare beneficiaries, for instance, that not a dime of any money dedicated to the Medicare Trust Fund will ever be used for anything but Medicare benefits, that, you know, there's more preventive care, there's lower drug costs, that people actually have responded very positively. But I think, you know, it's scary to some folks, and frankly, there are people who absolutely do not want any change at all and feel that, you know, the status quo is fine, and they will always be unhappy with moving forward. The special interests have a big stake in this multi-billion dollar drug and insurance industry that, frankly, has had a great control over the legislation that's been written and over the last number of years, and stopping any kind of legislative change. So there are big stakes in this debate, but I think what the president has done and will continue to do is remind everyone what's at stake if we do nothing.
The public option issue has become a big tripwire, government-run insurance option for Americans. August 16th, you put a new sort of wrinkle on it, saying it was not, we need not see it as the administration as essential to reform. Do you now? Headlines are saying that the president will endorse a public option in his speech tonight.
You know, I said on the 16th of August what I have said for the last 3 months, which is the public option, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the best ways to guarantee cost control, keep private insurers honest, and make sure that there is some competitive way to control costs and give consumers choices, in particularly in marketplaces where there is no choice. Are there potentially other ways of doing that? Maybe. But I think cost control and consumer choice is essential, and absent in many parts of the country, having a public plan compete side by side with private plans, you don't have that. Ironically, you know, the public plan is a compromised position. There are many members of Congress and certainly many members of the American public who are anxious to have a single-payer plan, get rid of all the private insurance companies, and move to a system where you cut out the middle guy altogether. The president has not supported that. I have not supported that. So the public option is really a competitive market strategy for a new marketplace that really only applies to people who either don't have affordable coverage right now because they're in the private insurance market buying individual coverage, or small business owners who, frankly, are paying the highest coverage of anyone in America.
It's early September when Americans sing Auld Lang Syne on New Year's Eve at the end of this year, beginning of the next. Will there be health care reform? Done.
I think there will be. I think the American public is still overwhelmingly convinced that the system we have is broken. It doesn't work for most people. Even if people have coverage they like right now, they're worried about next week or next month. They're worried about when their kids graduate from college. They're worried about a system where the costs are going up three times faster than wages, and health inflation beats all other inflation. So I think fundamentally people understand that we need a change in a system. We need to shift to a wellness and prevention system and get better health outcomes for the dollars that we spend. We need our businesses to be competitive internationally and not layer these high costs of health care onto every product that we sell. So there is a momentum for change. This is tough work. This is a big system that's been in place for years, and fundamentally, an overhaul, and I think the president is absolutely right, needs to be comprehensive. You can't tackle a bit of it without having bad ramifications on the rest. We need a comprehensive look at how you change outcomes, how you lower costs, and how you make coverage affordable for everyone, and change once and for all these insurance rules that lock people out of the market.
Kathleen Sebelius, U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, former governor of Kansas. Madam Secretary, thanks for being with us today.
Great to talk to you, Tom.
Let's go to Washington right now and CeCe Conley. She covers health care for The Washington Post. CeCe, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Tom, thanks for having me.
So how high is the cliff Obama needs to climb tonight?
Well, it's a pretty steep cliff. It's steep in part because he raised expectations. He had set those deadlines of saying he wanted the House and Senate to vote on bills on the floor before that August recess. That, of course, didn't happen. And then it was a very rocky 6-week recess period for the president's signature policy issue. So as a result, he's in a high stakes position tonight. But it's certainly not impossible. I mean, recall that Democrats easily control the House of Representatives. Speaker Nancy Pelosi can afford to let 40 or so of her members vote no on a health reform bill. In the Senate, it's a tighter margin, but Democrats still hold the advantage. So it's certainly not an impossibility, but it's a very hard task.
You heard Secretary Sebelius say by the end of the year they will have it doable. The politics are unfolding even in these last couple of days. Are things looking brighter than they did in the midst of the town hall fury or not?
They're probably looking a little bit brighter from the administration perspective because, as Secretary Sebelius pointed out, there really started some false information started getting out. You, of course, know about the death panels and some of the talk about kill granny, pull the plug on granny. And interestingly, what Secretary Sebelius didn't mention, of course, was that it took the White House a while to really respond to those attacks. I mean, I've spoken to a number of veterans of the Clinton effort, et cetera, and they said, look, you had to brace for some very potent opposition, even if you didn't know exactly what it was going to be. So it was a little bit surprising to see this Obama political team a little slow on the response. But I think now they're back on top of their game.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about health care reform and the president's challenge tonight. CeCe Conley is with us. She covers health care for The Washington Post. It's all on the line as the president goes before a joint session of Congress this evening and, of course, much of the American public tuning in as well. This is one that will ultimately affect everyone. CeCe Conley, let's listen for just a moment. This is 16 years ago this month, September 23rd, 1993. Then-President Bill Clinton went before Congress, just as President Obama will tonight, to press for health care reform. A rousing performance showed well in the opinion polls. Of course, his efforts famously went down in flames.
Our health care is too uncertain and too expensive, too bureaucratic and too wasteful. It has too much fraud and too much greed. At long last, after decades of false starts, we must make this our most urgent priority, giving every American health security, health care that can never be taken away, health care that is always there. That is what we must do tonight.
The applause was loud. The effort failed. CeCe Conley, step back for a second. Is this president in a better position than Bill Clinton was or not at this point in the current debate?
Well, he's certainly much farther along than President Bill Clinton was at this juncture. As you point out, 16 years ago, this very month, Bill Clinton was really just launching the effort. They didn't drop their bill, that 1,300-page behemoth, until later in the fall of 93. And then, of course, it dragged on through much of 94 until really summer of 94 when effort was kind of officially declared dead. So in that sense, this time around, we're much farther along. We've had several House committees and one Senate committee have already acted on versions of legislation. And Tom, of course, you and I have spoken a great deal about the Senate Finance Committee and the Gang of Six, the bipartisan group that has been trying so hard to forge consensus. And
with Max Baucus
there. They're still at it right up to the probably the minute that the president enters the House chamber. I think Max Baucus will still be trying to corral some support, and we're not certain that he's going to be able to pull that off. But certainly there are ways that you can see Democrats moving legislation forward.
So what's the key? Is it what he says? Is it the particular policy points he pushes for tonight? Is it how he says it? What could turn the key in the lock here?
Well, it's just a speech, and even though we all in here in Washington and get all worked up about these big events, and it's kind of like prom night or something, we figure out what we're going to wear and the best seat in the House and all of that good stuff. It's still just one speech, and so I think that Secretary Sebelius is right that President Obama is going to have to use his rhetorical skills to remind lawmakers as well as the public about the things that are not working so well in the system, really kind of refocus the conversation back on the themes that he wants to get it refocused on, and then he is going to have some more specificity, some more things that he's willing to kind of spend some political capital to go out in the country and sell, because ultimately what these members of Congress need to know is that if they go ahead forward with President Obama on a big, difficult issue like this, that they're not going to pay a terrible price when they're up for re-election in 2010.
How many Republicans does he need? Bottom line. Is it just one? Is it just Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine?
It is potentially one, Tom, if we're talking about that magic 60 votes in the Senate to break any sort of a filibuster. And the reason for that is with the passing of Senator Kennedy, you now have 59 votes. Two of them are independent members of the chamber, but who generally would vote with Democrats, at least procedurally. Now, even as I say this, though, Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, is certainly thinking to himself and having conversations with about a half a dozen of those Senate Democrats who tend to be moderate and could at any moment say, I'm not comfortable with certain elements here.
Like a public option.
It could be a public option, a government-sponsored alternative to the private insurers out there. It could be any number of things. So some of these members will look at legislation and say, you don't do enough for my rural hospitals. And then some of the deal-making and the horse trading begins. So the speech tonight is important, but you're going to see a lot of behind-the-scenes work, potentially some horse trading along the way, but also some work by President Obama to give what we refer to as political cover for these difficult votes.
Cece Conley covers healthcare for The Washington Post. Cece, thank you very much for joining us on this day. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
With us now, first from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Jonathan Cohn. He writes The Treatment, the New Republic's healthcare blog. He's a senior editor at The New Republic, author of Sick. Jonathan Cohn, thanks very much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
And Gail Wilensky joins us again from Washington, D.C., economist and senior fellow at Project Hope. It's an international health education foundation. She ran Medicare and Medicaid under President George H.W. Bush. She was an advisor to John McCain's campaign on health care. Gail Wilensky, welcome back to the show.
Very nice to be with you again.
First to you, Jonathan. I mean, we've got David Axelrod saying that I don't know who he means by but we agree on 80% of this thing. Let's do the final 20%. Let's get the job done. Is there some 80% sitting out there that's a winnable consensus on already? And what is it if it's there, Jonathan?
I don't know if it would be, I would say, quite 80%, but there has always been, from day one, a rather broad consensus, one that even extends to some quarters, I would say, of the Republican Party, about what a reformed system should look like. The basic idea is people who have insurance from their job should get to keep it. Everybody else, we're going to try to get you into some kind of structured, regulated market where you can choose from a set of insurance options. And the idea is that everybody, regardless of their pre-existing medical condition, would be able to get insurance, and we'd make that insurance affordable in the short term by offering subsidies, offering assistance. So if you're poor, we'll give you a little extra money so you can afford the premiums. And over the long term, by doing something to make our healthcare system more rational, to the phrase you've probably heard is bend the curve, slow down the growth in healthcare costs, inflation. And the idea is that if you do that, not only does insurance become more affordable, but of course, if you're not spending as much money on your healthcare, that's a little more money in your paycheck and in the government's treasury. And I think broadly speaking, there is certainly within the Democratic Party and even to some parts of the Republican Party, broad agreement about those principles. It's when you get down to the level of detail and you get into some other areas like the public option that the you see the controversy come
up. Now, everybody seems to be converging around a requirement that every American have health care, buy health care, be penalized if they don't, get a subsidy if they do, and they need a subsidy. Am I right on that, Jonathan?
There is a convergence, and again, there are people who don't like this idea, obviously, but there are a number of reasons to do that. First and foremost, if you're going to tell insurance companies they have to give insurance to anybody, regardless of pre-existing condition, they can't charge you more if you're sick. You have to promise them that they'll get a fair shake, because you don't want a situation where people wait until they're sick, wait until they have hospital bills, and then buy insurance. So you want everybody in the system. In addition, there is an efficiency. The more people in the system, it just makes the system run better. You don't have people running off to the emergency room for routine care, jumping in and out of coverage. And I also think there's a sense of shared responsibility here. And this is, I think, you hear this a little more from conservatives, but as speaking as a liberal, I wholeheartedly support this idea that I think everybody ought to have access to affordable health insurance. You should never have to go bankrupt in order to get your medical care. But I think it's good to make you pay a little bit, pay what you can, and take your responsibility in the same way that we say, look, we're going to protect your house in case of a fire. We're going to give you a fire department. But you know what? You're going to have to pay some taxes to support the fire department. Well, it's the same exact principle.
Gail Wilensky, you advised John McCain on health care. Now, here we are. It's September. President Obama did not get it before the August recess. We all saw the fireworks. There may be few or no Republican votes for a package that comes through here, but do you see something that you think can make it through Congress?
I hope so. There is indeed widespread agreement that we have too many people without insurance coverage, that we have an unsustainable health care spending problem, and we don't get enough value for what we spend. The problem that we get into is specifically how do we pay for those expansions, and how do we try to get better spending levels, more sustainable spending levels. There are Republicans who want to support this. We've seen this in the Senate. There are some in the House, but the atmosphere is much more partisan in the House, and I think probably very difficult to achieve consensus across parties. Of course, the Democrats are not exactly united on these issues themselves. The more conservative Democrats, the Blue Dogs, have raised many of the concerns, like whether a public option is consistent with private insurance over the long haul. I hope the optimism we've heard on this phone call is going to prevail and that we indeed get something through the Congress, but we've got to make sure it's the right something.
Let's hear from our listeners. They're going to be listening tonight. Karen in Topsfield, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Karen. What do you see? What do you hope for?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I think, you know, my expectation of this evening's, you know, speech is that he get back on message to what your you know, participants have been saying, you know, we need to get back to what's what we were going after, as opposed to, you know, all the rhetoric and you know, false information that's been floating around and you know, everyone's nitpicking relative to individual details. It's to cover everyone. It's to drive costs down. You know, it's people taking responsibility for their own health.
But, Karen, a lot of it has not been what you'd call nitpicking. I mean, some of the criticisms have been as broad as it could possibly be, that this is, you know, taking the United States away from its historic economy, the socialist medicine and all the rest. That's about as broad a critique as you could make.
Yeah, well, we're a wealthy nation, and I find it quite deplorable that we have people, you know, and I come from a very large family, and I could spend, you know, a fair amount of time telling you, you know, horrific stories about, you know, healthcare coverage and lacks of coverage.
Many families can,
you know, bankruptcy and things of that nature that have occurred in my own family. I haven't had to deal with that because, you know, my husband and I are fortunate. But, you know, it touches everyone, and I find it, you know, I guess it's beyond me. That people, you know, continue to try to use, you know, the socialism aspect and, you know, we're a wealthy country, you know, we have the best healthcare, you know, in the world. There's no reason why our citizens should not have access to that health care, should worry that when they get sick that they may lose their homes and choose to potentially die rather than get the care that they need.
So you're ready for the president to push and push hard right there. Karen, thanks for that. Let me get one more right here from Plattsburgh, New York. Andrew, you're on the air.
Oh, wonderful to be on. On the Canadian border, we realize that our biggest neighbor just to the north is fully covered by health care. We need to get rid of the companies that publish these huge catalogs that no one can understand of what's included, what's not included. Doctors need to be paid a salary, not per service. But no one's dying in Canada. Health care there is wonderful. I've been there. I know the deal. I think we have to get rid of these crazy people like Senator Barney Frank said. They have the intelligence of a dining room table spouting that these death panels. No death panels. Just people living wonderful lives in Canada. There's no exclusions.
Well, it's still your fellow citizens you and he are talking about, and they've got a vote and a voice here, too. Thanks for your call, Andrew. Jonathan, you've written recently about why reform survived August, as the headline on your piece put it. Why do you think it's still out there and kicking and possible? Make the case. I mean, the polls have gone down. There was a sense of disarray just a few weeks ago, and that was after the president made his big last public appeal for reform.
Yeah, it was. I have to say, it was a. If you are a supporter of reform, an advocate of reform, it would have been hard to script an August that went that was worse. Things just did not go very well, and I know there were many times when it really did look like they had blown this. But at the end of the day, you know, you sort of the smoke clears. You look around at the rubble, and people are still standing. The fundamental fact is, you do still have this consensus that we spoke about earlier. Architects of reform in the Congress, in the White House, have kept most of the key interest groups at the table. Now, this has been somewhat controversial. Basically, they've made some deals. They've said to the drug companies, for instance, we will ask you to give up some possible revenues, but not that much. And frankly, the drug industry and the insurance industry are going to end up doing pretty well out of these reforms if they pass. But at the same time, they're at the table. And for example, so you have the drug industry, instead of putting $150 million into advertising against reform, they are spending $150 million advertising for reform. So you have that. You also have a sense where I think the Democratic Party remembers 1994. They recall the fact that they did nothing, and they were punished, I think, in part for that. And I think there's a sense that they need to deliver something, that electorally speaking, if they want to run for re-election and they come and say, we did nothing on health care, that is bound to be a lot worse than doing something, even if it's a modest plan. So there's a lot of self-motivation to do something. And then I think finally, at the end of the day, when all is said and done, your caller before Karen, I thought she was quite eloquent. The underlying point here is I do think at the end of the day, people realize that this could happen to them or somebody they know, and they are vulnerable, and they want some change. And when all is said and done, if they can be convinced, and this is, I think, the president's job tonight, if they can be convinced that what is being done will certainly not hurt them and hopefully make them a little safer, a little more secure, I think people will go along with it. And I think the Democrats know that however hard it is to get that through now, whatever kind of attacks they have to weather, that 1 year down the road, 2 years down the road, 4 years down the road, the voters will look back on this and say, hey, this helped me. This made my life more secure. This made my life better, and I appreciate that. So I think at the end of the day, Democrats do have the numbers in Congress to pass this one way or another. It may not be everything I want it to be, but they'll pass something. And I think at the end of the day, that momentum will carry the reform through.
Gail Wilensky, do you think it will happen? And does Obama win tonight by singing Kumbaya with the bipartisan appeal, or by getting tough, by something in between, if there's room in between those?
I think he has to be compelling to the public about why it is so critical that the Congress pass some legislation and signal a willingness, again, not so much on bringing aboard Republicans, although they may need some Republicans in the Senate in order to get to their 60 number, but because they're going to need to bring Democrats of very different persuasions, as you've been hearing. If the Democrats really held together, they can, for the most part, ignore Republicans, but the Democrats have been very different on their views. I would like to say one word about the August town meetings. While there was certainly some disinformation being disseminated, death panels, and as Jonathan knows, I've been very outspoken about the falsity of those charges, I believe what you were also seeing is uneasiness by middle America about the expansion they've seen of government in their lives in the last year in the financial sector, looking at CEO pay, taking a big share of GM and Chrysler, giving money to people to buy cars, having significant significantly large unfunded spending bills like the stimulus package.
Hold the list. We have to take a short break here. We're looking at health care reform and the president's challenge tonight. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about health care reform and the president's challenge tonight as he makes his big speech before a joint session of Congress and the nation. Gail Walensky is with us. She ran Medicare and Medicaid programs under President George H.W. Bush, was an advisor to John McCain's campaign on health care. John Cone joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. He's senior editor at the New Republic, writes the Treatment Healthcare blog. There is author of Sick. Let's go to Kevin in Stuart, Florida. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey, why can't we get an accurate number from the president? It's not $47 million by any estimate. The true number is probably closer to $15
million. What, of uninsured Americans, you're saying?
Yes, people that need medical insurance. It's much, much too inflated. You cannot trust the man if he isn't going to be honest up front.
That number's been out there for a long time. Where do you? If it's $15 million, what's the difference? I'm not saying it is.
Which President Obama himself said the illegals aren't covered. You're probably talking $10 million right there. Take away people that just don't want to buy it. I have friends like that that make between $70,000 to $80,000 a year. They're not buying insurance. They use the emergency rooms as condos. And take away people eligible for some other program that the government already has, but they do not sign up for whatever reason. So it's just disingenuous not to use an accurate number.
But what are you saying with that, Kevin? We'll come to the issue of accuracy, but are you saying, so, hey, it's smaller, so we don't need health care reform?
No. Yes, we do need health care reform, but you have to be honest with people and use the honest $15 million. I mean, how expensive is $15 million versus $47 million? Maybe that's the problem. If you're trying to sell something, you want to sell a Lexus, and you really only need to sell an Impala. That's what the average American wants to know up front. Hey, what is this going to cost me? If you're saying $47 million, that's unaffordable. $1 trillion. Nothing in the American government runs without inflated by 50% more than what they say.
Let us pick it up, Kevin. We've got the point. Gail, I'll come first to you. Did John McCain look out and see $47 million uninsured or 15?
Well, that is the number that the census estimates from the current population survey. There may be some illegals in there. They're very hard to estimate. The caller is correct. There is some number of people who say thanks but no thanks. They're offered insurance, choose not to buy it for whatever reason. As John had mentioned, we want to make sure everybody gets in insurance because it becomes very distorted if people wait until they're sick in order to get insurance. But we have to remember, getting people insured is only a part of the problem. It's actually the easier part of the problem to solve. Figuring out how to slow spending, how to get more value for what we spend, making sure we get the appropriate health care, that's going to be at least as much challenge as it is to get people with insurance coverage. A third of the people who are uninsured are below the poverty line. That number has been consistent for the last 30 years. So I don't know if it's precisely 47. It's more than $15 million.
Jonathan, that number matters because paying for whatever happens, as our caller Kevin says, is a big deal. What is I know there's you know a number of nearly half a dozen congressional committees, and they've got their different ways here. But what is broadly on the table in terms of how to pay for this coverage at this point, Jonathan?
Well, there are a number of options of how to pay for reform, and obviously the first question you have to ask is how much you want to pay. Just to address your call, the other side, Gail, as usual, is making a lot of sense. The one thing I would add is that when we talk about the price of reform, you know, it's not merely spending to get insurance to people who don't have it. A lot of that money is subsidies for people who are actually buying insurance now but are paying, frankly, a lot more than they can afford. They're really struggling. A lot of the money tied up in reform goes to assist people who are, you know, and that's what we'd call working class, lower middle class, who are really having to make difficult trade-offs in order to afford their insurance. And so this is assistance for people who are presently insured but really struggling with it and trying to make life a little easier for them. So it's not just the uninsured, but it's helping out the presently insured both to afford insurance and to make sure they have protection so that if they get sick, they're not exposed to outrageous out-of-pocket costs. We hear stories all the time of people who have cancer, they have insurance, and by the time they're done paying their medical bills, they have to declare bankruptcy. But
It's to help them, but it's also to, in most of these plans, to prod them into coverage, right? I mean, all the way up to 300% or so of the poverty line, there will be penalties here if you don't get your family covered. So help if you do, penalties if you don't.
Absolutely. And, you know, your caller was, I think, you know, was saying there are these people who choose not to get insurance and then they end up in the emergency room. I don't know if they would call it a condo, but, you know, they don't want to live there.
You know,
yeah, and you know what? I agree with your caller. I think this is a matter of individual responsibility. If you can afford to buy insurance, I think in the same way we make you pay for the fire department, we make you pay into the Social Security system, we should make you pay for health insurance. Because at the end of the day, when you get sick and you have an emergency, you're going to show up at the emergency room and we're going to take care of you and we're going to pay for it. And so, you know, if you have the money to pay for that, you should have to pay for it. So that is why we want to require everybody to get health insurance.
But what's the president going to say on cost tonight, for example, that he didn't say at his big July 22nd press conference? Everybody was focused on that. They said, you know, all the chips are on the table here. And that's, you know, not this month, not last month, but 6 weeks back now.
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure if you're looking for new substantive wrinkles in tonight's speech. I'm not sure there's going to be that many. I mean, he may put a few more markers down about his priorities because obviously he's sketched out his health care plan. He's been consistent since the first day he ran for president about what he wanted to do. I don't think you're going to see new wrinkles in how he wants to accomplish things. I assume we'll hear the same message about costs he gave them. But, you know, I have to say I was among those people who thought the message on costs he's been sending has actually been the right one. To some extent, the reason he got into trouble in August, all this stuff about death panels. You know, a lot of this, to the extent there was a bit of reality in these charges, they were connected to efforts to make healthcare more efficient. If you do that, you are going to sort of look for ways to sort of cut out care that is wasteful. You are going to look for ways to spend your money more efficiently. I think it's to the administration's credit. They've tried to take that problem seriously. Of course, when you take that problem seriously, you inevitably are going to give people some grist for saying, aha, you're going to pull the plug on grandma. So I think you'll hear in terms of cost, what are they going to say? I think they're going to say what they've said all along. And I think to their credit, at least rhetorically, they've been talking about the right things.
And the public option, Gail, can he bring along House Democrats in sufficient number if he doesn't have it? Nancy Pelosi talking just yesterday still about it, its importance. On the other hand, the headlines are saying today, the day of the speech, Obama, you know, to endorse public option. But does he or doesn't he?
I think he would be wise not to. He will be under a lot of pressure from the liberal Democratic wing, as you've just said, to do so. I believe a public option is not necessary and can be harmful because I believe you'll see what happens with Medicare, which is reimbursement that's less than cost. On average, hospitals receive 6% under cost from Medicare. Physicians get paid on average 80% of what they receive in private insurance. It is hard to imagine a public plan that won't use the power of government to do similar things. You can accomplish what the secretary talked about and what the president has talked about through other strategies, reform insurance companies by having regulations in terms of pre-existing conditions and non-discrimination. You don't need to have a public plan for that. Massachusetts is a perfect example. You have those laws on the books and you don't have a public plan. It is the issue that will drive the blue dogs into potential disagreement with the president. It is a very serious issue with regard to the Senate, not just because of Republicans, but because of some of the more conservative Democrats and independents like Senator Lieberman, who are needed if you are going to be able to get to 60 votes. So I think this is going to be a real issue of leadership for the president. Can he be convincing both to the American public and to the Congress in terms of leading them to a solution? I really wish they hadn't gotten stuck on this issue. I think it is a divergence from the issues of how to try to get coverage out and how to try to slow spending. We don't need a public plan. I hate to see the president getting boxed into this one.
Jonathan Cohn, count votes for us here. Can the White House get health care reform with a public option? Can they get it without a public option? Look at the Senate. Look at the House. How's it look?
Well, the numbers don't look good for getting a public option. And speaking, Gail and I were on the show a few weeks ago, and we had a debate about this issue, and this is one of the places where we have a difference of opinion. Mm-hmm. I'm an early and enthusiastic public option backer, but the numbers are what the numbers are. The public may, I think, be more supportive of the idea, but it doesn't look like they have the numbers in Congress, particularly in the Senate. And again, it's not, as Gail says, it is not just Republicans. It is also moderate and conservative Democrats. Speaking as a liberal, I do think there are the numbers there to get reform without a public option. And I think the question for liberals ought to be, if they're going to give up the public option, what are they going to get instead? I mean, for a lot of people, myself included, the appeal of a public option is in part a fail-safe. It's a security blanket. It's knowing that the kind of affordable insurance will be available. If you're going to take that out of the equation, we have to be extra, extra careful that the regulations on the insurance industry work and that there's enough financial assistance for people who won't be able to buy insurance on their own.
And what about this trigger that's being put out there as maybe a compromise? If they don't legislate it now, the public option, and insurance companies don't get people covered in an adequate fund by some date specified, then a public option would come in. Is that eyewash? Is that real? What do you think of that, Jonathan?
In principle, this may be the way you settle this. You're seeing broad hints from even liberal Democrats that they could possibly work with the trigger. Again, it's all in the details. Is the trigger real? Does it have a threshold? In other words, is the threshold set high enough so that we'll make sure the insurance industry is doing what we want it to do? And then is the public plan itself that would kick in, is that a strong public plan? I think, again, speaking in terms of insofar as the goal of a public plan is to provide a guarantee that insurance is available in a certain way at a certain price, I believe that a trigger might be a way to accomplish that. But again, it's all in the details. And I think if you're going to talk about a trigger and if you're going to get liberal Democrats to buy into this, they need to be assured that, okay, we will make those guarantees. And Gail is absolutely right about Massachusetts. I think that's been an undersold success story. There are countries abroad where they make universal coverage work strictly with private insurance. But if you look at those countries abroad in particular, they have very strong regulation of the insurance industry. It's vital, absolutely critical, that if liberals are going to give up the public plan or give in to a, or go with a compromise like a trigger, they have those guarantees in place.
Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. And Frank, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call.
Yes.
Interesting discussion. I think the best compromise for the public option could be co-ops that are run on a nonprofit basis at each state. And then people who can enter the co-ops, and the premiums are means-tested, so if they can't afford it, they would be subsidized. This could be a compromise that everybody could live with, and I think that would be necessary so that we can give coverage to everyone, so that then we can go to the insurance companies and regulate them so that they would not deny somebody because of their pre-existing condition, et cetera, et cetera.
But will that be strong enough? Will that be widespread enough, Frank, to really offer a counterway to counterpath to the insurance path if that's not working?
I believe it would be because if it's run on a nonprofit basis, right there's 15% discount to the premiums that the insurance companies charge, and it would be cheaper, and then more and more people will go into it, and overall it would expand coverage. But there's one element that I want to get in here in this discussion. We keep talking about cost, but two major components of the cost are taken off the table. One is tort, the other one is pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceuticals cut a back deal with the White House, and tort is not discussed because they get so much campaign contributions. And the absence of these two topics makes the entire discussion disingenuous.
It's an important one. Frank, let us pick it up. Jonathan, there's been some chatter that the president may say something about medical liability, lawsuits, tort reform in this speech tonight. Is there a political purpose in that? Is there a practical necessity on the cost front, as Frank suggests?
I would say, first of all, the evidence that malpractice lawsuits are a major driver of cost is pretty shaky. Most of the economists I know will tell you that it may have some effect, but even if you factor in defensive medicine, it's not the main reason or even one of the main reasons why healthcare is so expensive. That said, I have always believed that the malpractice system we have is horrible. It's not good for doctors for all the obvious reasons. It's really not good for patients. Most people who have medical errors are never compensated, whether they were the result of negligence or just normal human error. So there is, I think, a strong substantive case for reforming the malpractice system. And in fact, Obama has at various points suggested he would be interested in that. And there are even some creative ways to do it so that you can fold it into a broader agenda that really improves quality and efficiency throughout the medical system. I said there wouldn't be many new substantive wrinkles tonight. I would not be surprised to hear a little bit more on that. It is a way to show a sort of reaching across the ideological divide, since this is traditionally an issue that conservatives and Republicans have championed. But I also think it's one that I think you will find quite a number of liberals, including those in the White House, would agree with on principle if it's done right.
Gail, swap hats for a minute here. You advised John McCain. The Republicans have said, you know, let's bring Obama down on health care. Let's make him fail. That will be his Waterloo. Everything else will fail after that. If Democrats want to get it through, if Obama wants to get something through, what do you suggest to him in his big speech tonight?
He needs to be compelling as to why it's so critical that something gets done, and doing nothing is not an option for the country and for the American public. I wish that statement hadn't been made. Healthcare reform is a serious issue. We shouldn't kick the can down the road another decade. I actually don't think it was the failure of the Democrats to get something done in 1994 that caused the loss of the election in 1994. I think it was what was being proposed so scared the American public, made people believe that they would be worse off, although the country might be better off. Those are the kind of dangers I think that Democrats need to think about, of being compelling to the American people that not only might the country as a whole be better off, but they as individuals will be better off, because it will make health care more certain, it'll make it more affordable, it will improve the quality. That's not an easy sell, and thus far the president has been struggling. The polls have really taken a significant decline in terms of how the American public is feeling about what the president has been proposing. If I were a Democrat, that's what I'd worry about tonight.
All ears on President Barack Obama tonight as he makes his case at this critical juncture for health care reform. I want to thank each of you, Gail Wilensky in Washington. Gail, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure.
And Jonathan Cohn, senior editor at The New Republic. Jonathan, thanks for your ongoing coverage, and thanks for being with us today.
Anytime.
Listeners, we'll all be listening. We'll be back tomorrow to see what the president said and what it means. Join us then. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.